Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and a special welcome to Professor Tana Akchan, our speaker for this evening. I should introduce our speaker briefly. He's a sociologist and historian, and he's chair in Armenian Genocide Studies at Clark University in Massachusetts in the United States. Dr. Akçam is the first scholar of Turkish origin to publicly acknowledge the Armenian Genocide, and his many books include A Shameful Act, The Armenian Genocide, and The Question of Turkish Responsibility. I should also thank the Armenian National Committee of Australia, and in particular Varshe Kamran Nian, who have brought the speaker to Australia and have asked the Sydney Institute to put on this function tonight, which we were delighted to do. I should also mention that Dr. Akçam's most recent book, The Young Turks' Crime Against Humanity, The Armenian Genocide and Ethnic Cleansing in the Ottoman Empire, has just been released this year by Princeton University Press. Janet Grundy has got some copies if you wish to purchase one after the talk tonight. And the topic for this evening's talk is Facing Turkey, Denial and the Turkish National Security Concept. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Good afternoon or good evening, and thank you very much for inviting me. I thank Armenian National Committee and thank you, Sydney Institute, to have me today. It's a pleasure for me, and I'm very excited, really. Sydney is a beautiful city, and I will enjoy every day, especially the Australian Shiraz. I'm in love with it, so I enjoy every day. Thank you very much. And today's topic is the Facing History. The Turkey's, I think it's a very familiar topic to you, the Australians. You had the similar problems over the decades in your own country, and my topic is why it is so difficult to face history and to acknowledge historic wrongdoings in Turkey. What are the reasons? And there are, of course, thousands of reasons we will maybe discuss at the end of my talk, but one of the important issue is the Turkey's national security concept. So I will talk on this security aspect of the problem of Armenian genocide. In 2009, in a raid against the ultra-nationalist shadowy terror organization Ergenekon, you might have heard the name, which is composed of mostly army and police officers and bureaucrats, Turkish police confiscated some documents. Among those documents was a file in which the names of five persons were listed along with their photos. They were targeted for assassination. My name was among this group. Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk and the Armenian journalist Hrant Dink, who, as you may know, was assassinated in January 2007, were two other names of that list. The title of the document, by the way, was The Traitors to National Security. All of people listed were known for being outspoken on the Armenian genocide and for asking the Turkish government to face this history real honestly. The shadowy terror organization Ergenekon was not alone in considering to be outspoken on Armenian genocide as a threat to national security of Turkey. As you may well know, over the last decades in Turkey, the government, along with the media, didn't hesitate to label anyone who has dared bring up the topic of the Armenian genocide as a traitor to the nation, to drag them from courtroom to courtroom. There were criminal investigations against me, against Hrant Dink, and against Orhan Pamuk, other intellectuals of Turkey, not to mention even to assassinate. One can therefore draw the conclusion that to be outspoken about the Armenian genocide is to be considered a threat to Turkish national security. One may understandably ask why. Before answering this question, though, I have to add that this is not just the view of the political elite or an ultra-nationalist terror organization, it also underpins the legal decision-makings. In a judgment in 2007 against two Turkish Armenian journalists, Arat Dink, son of assassinated journalist Hrant Dink, and Sarkis Seropian, who received suspended sentences of a year imprisonment for using the term genocide, the Turkish court stated, I'm now quoting from the verdict of the court, quote, talk about genocide, both in Turkey and in other countries, unfavorably affects national security and the national interests. And the court continues. The claim of genocide has become part of and the means of special plans aiming to change the geographic political boundaries of Turkey, and a campaign to demolish its physical and legal structure. End quote. So, then, due to the national security concerns of Turkey, the court declared that the claim of genocide in 1915 is not protected speech. To quote again from the indictment, the use of these freedoms can be limited in accordance with aims such as the protection of national security, of public order, of public security of Turkey. End quote. The situation is actually is not much different in the United States. Whenever the Armenians bring a resolution on the floor of the Congress, you hear always the same argument. We cannot accept the genocide because of our United States national interest in the Middle East. So United States has a security interest in the Middle East, and because of this reason, they cannot accept the genocide claim. Indeed, it would appear that, as the court stated, using the term genocide unfavorably affects the national security and national interest of Turkey and United States, and I'm sure you will hear the same arguments here in Australia also if Armenians bring the same resolution to the floor of the parliament. We have two sets of arguments here, which are brought up in opposition to one another. National security versus morality, or in a very different way, realists versus moral fundamentalists. The realists emphasize national security concern of their country, Australia, Middle East, United States, Middle East, national security concern of these countries. And on the other side, we have fundamentalist moralists emphasizing the supremacy of morality against real interests. The point that I want to make here is that pitting national interest against morality as mutually exclusive is just plain wrong. In fact, what I really believe is that, as the recent developments in the Middle East clearly teaches us, any security policy in the region that excludes morality cannot be a realistic policy and even undermines national security. Indeed, if one knows Turkey and the Middle East, one would easily recognize that history and historical injustices are not just dead issues from the past. The past is present in the Middle East. So therefore, morality is a very real issue. And for real politics to be successful in the region, moral values in this instance, the specific one of acknowledging historic wrongdoings, must be integrated into a policy of national security. There is a strong interconnection between security, democracy, and facing history in the Middle East. This is my central argument. Even a passing glance of the recent developments at the region makes it as clear that historical injustices and the persistent denial of these injustices by one or other state or by one or other ethnic groups is the major stumbling block, not only for the democratization of the nation, of the region, but also for the establishment of stable relations between different ethnic and religious groups. This is core reality you can see every day in the news also. My central argument is that a failure to confront history, honestly, is one of the major reasons for insecurity and instability in the region. The question that I have struggled to find an answer to is, why is the discussion of historic injustices, something that goes to the heart of human rights, perceived as a threat to national security of Turkey. I propose that we take the argument about national security of Turkey very seriously. We can say that facing history and acknowledging a wrongdoing is a national security concern. They must be crazy. But let's take it very seriously. This is my point. And then try to examine the roots of this mentality and show the reason why it must be changed. The mindset that an open discussion of history creates a security problem originates actually during the time of establishment of Turkish Republic. From the late Ottoman time to the present, there has been a continuous tension between states' concern for secure borders and society's need to come to terms with abuses of human rights. In the history, security and territorial integrity of a crumbling empire and the emerging Turkish Republic and human rights abuses can be linked to the two faces of a coin. Indeed, this is the period 1918-1922, and I would like to invite you to look a little bit closer to that period of time. There will be a historical overview of this period. I hope you are familiar at least with some general knowledge of that period. When the First World War ended, with the Ottoman defeat, working out the terms of peace settlement, the political decision makers of the time grappled with two distinct yet related problems, questions. The first question was the territorial integrity of the Ottoman state, and the second question was the wartime atrocities committed by the ruling Union and Progress Party against Ottoman Armenian citizens. The question about the first issue, about the Ottoman sovereignty, was the following. Should the Ottoman state retain its independence? This was a serious question. Should new states be permitted to arise on the territory of Ottoman Empire? If so, how should be the borders of the new states be defined? The question regarding the second issue was, what can be done about the wartime crimes against the Armenians and the perpetrator of the atrocities? How should the perpetrator be punished? The question related to a different set of issues which hadn't been tackled separately and were rather intertwined with each other. The question related to the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire led to the formation of two different viewpoints. The Turkish nationalist movement, under the leadership of Mustafa Kemal, favored continued sovereignty within reduced borders as it was defined 1918 Modros ceasefire treaty. The Allied power and the ethnic religious groups such as Greeks, Armenians, and Kurds, on the other hand, argued for the establishment of new states on both occupied and unoccupied territory of the Ottoman Empire. This is the basic of the historic conflict of the period. The successive treaties, you may know, Sèvres Agreement 1920 and Lausanne Agreement 1923 reflected these divergent points of view. As a result of this fight over territory in the early period of the Republic, a general understanding of history in modern Turkey emerged, which can be formulated following way, and you have to also keep in mind, this is how we were raised in Turkey. This is how I learned my own history in the schools in Turkey. We were learned, the Turks, we see ourselves as a legitimate successor of the Ottoman Empire, defended our sole remaining territory against Armenians, Greeks, and to a lesser degree against the Kurds, who were trying to carve up Anatolia into nation states, and with the support of British, French, and Italians. The 1920 Sèvres Treaty resolved the question of territory in favor of the non-Turkish nationalities. For the Turks, therefore, Sèvres remains a black mark in our history. Although it did not fully reflect their demand of territory, the Treaty of Sèvres represented an unprecedented historic opportunity to resolve the territorial issue in favor of Armenians, Greeks, and Kurds. Conversely, the 1923 Treaty of Lausanne, which guaranteed Turkish dominance in Anatolia for the Turks, which we are proud having this treaty in Turkey. Lausanne is a milestone and validation of our continued national existence. And most of the Armenian friends here in the room, Lausanne Agreement was regarded or is regarded as a great historical injustice. So we have here two arguments, Sèvres and Lausanne, and the assessment of both arguments. And on the question of territory. These two treaties but would symbolize also how the injustices committed against Armenians and other Christians during the war would be addressed. The central question was, how would those perpetrators of human rights abuses during the war be punished? Although everyone, including the Turkish nationalists, agreed that these crimes should not be left unpunished, maybe to your surprise, there was uncertainty about the scope of the penalty. One group advocated for the trial and punishment only some first-hand criminals, as well as some of the top Union and Progress Party leaders. Another group advocated for the trials of individual suspects, casting the net as wide as possible, and for the punitive dismemberment of the Ottoman state into new states created on its territory. The position of the Entente power was very, allied power was very simple and clear. They said that the Turks, so to speak, organized the massacre of other people, in particular the Armenians, during the First World War. It was therefore necessary to punish the Turks collectively in order to rescue the subject peoples, Arabs as well as Greeks, Armenians, from Turkish domination. Punishing the Turks was to be accomplished in two phases. So I'm reading from a telegram which was sent from Istanbul, 1919 April, by British High Commissioner to the Paris peace negotiations, how he considers to solve the problem. He says, "In order to punish all of those persons who are guilty of the Armenian horrors, it is necessary to punish the Turks as a group. Therefore," he says, "I propose that the punishment be given on a national level through the partitioning up of the last Turkish Empire, and on a personal level by trying those high officials who are on the list in my possession, and in a manner that would serve as an example for their successors." In short, casting the net as widely as possible, the Allied powers advocated for the trials of individual suspects for the punitive dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire into new states created on its territory. So the main ostensible reason for partitioning Anatolia among various national groups was motivated by the great powers' desire to punish Turks for the barbarous act they had committed. They never publicly said that they had colonial interest, so this is the reason why they should partition the region. They ostensibly used this human rights aspect of the problem. What was the attitude of the Turkish position relative to the punishment of the criminals? Recall or remember that after the First World War, there were two major governments in Anatolia. One was the government in Istanbul, successor of the Ottoman Empire, and the other was the government of nationalists under the leadership of Mustafa Kemal in Ankara. So you had two different governments, two different political bodies, and they were trying to win the overhand in Anatolia. And both Istanbul and Ankara, the Ottoman Empire's successors and the nationalists in Ankara, agreed with allies powers that the perpetrator should be tried. This is maybe new for you. Ankara and Istanbul, on the other hand, vehemently opposed the punitive partition of Anatolia. The question was one of the central issues when both Ankara and Istanbul came together and negotiated for the upcoming elections, and Ankara and Istanbul government signed five protocols for the upcoming Ottoman Parliament's elections. You can read all this story in my books. Now I'm quoting you from these protocols signed by Istanbul and Ankara government, how they proceed regarding the punishment of perpetrator. This is the protocol number one. It says, Ittihadism, this is the Party of Union and Progress, they organized the Armenian genocide. Or Ittihadism, or Party of Union and Progress Party, or any hint of it is reawakening is politically very damaging. So they consider Union and Progress Party's awakening very damaging. And it is judicially and politically necessary to punish those who committed crimes in connection with the deportation. End quote. And in the third protocol, they both describe the atrocities as evil deeds of the Union and Progress Party. And the founder of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal, addressing the Turkish parliament on April 24, 1920, called the atrocities against Armenians as a shameful act. Now, keep in mind, Mustafa Kemal was not a human rights activist or an altruist. He was a nationalist and a politician. The underlying reason in supporting the punishment of perpetrators of wartime crimes was their expectation from the ongoing Paris Peace Conference. The Allied powers grabbed every opportunity to remind the Turks that if they accepted a positive outcome from the Paris talks, actions absolutely had to be taken against the perpetrator of the war crimes. So the Mustafa Kemal-led government in Ankara and the administration in Istanbul believed that the war crime trial were the price for obtaining national sovereignty. They set up the military tribunal. There were 200 defendants, more than 60 trials, 17 people sentenced to death penalty. Three of them were hanged. September 1919, to the Istanbul government, Mustafa Kemal wrote the following note. I quote, "The punishment of the perpetrators," he says, "should not stay on paper, but should be carried out, since this would successively impress the foreign element." Oh, they want to impress the foreign elements to get better result from Paris peace talks. This strategy failed. In April 22, the provisions of Sèvres Agreement became known, according to which it was proposed to punish the Turks for the war crimes by the partitioning of the Ottoman territory. In the same month, April 1919, the Istanbul court martial, which had been established in November 18 and which was also in the process of trying the perpetrator of the Armenian atrocities, now under pressure from Allied powers, began trying the entire almost Turkish national leadership. Mustafa Kemal foremost among them, who were opposed to the partitioning of Anatolia, and Mustafa Kemal and around 100 Turkish nationalists were sentenced to death in absentia by the same court which was trying the perpetrator of Armenian genocide. They mixed the history with each other. When the Turkish nationalists realized that their support for the punishment of war criminals was not going to prevent partitioning of Anatolia and was in fact going to lead to their own persecutions and punishment, their attitude changed totally. This is the beginning of Turkish denial policy. As Mustafa Kemal wrote a couple months later, the other letter that I wrote, quoted, was from September 1919, where he said, "The punishment should not stay on the paper." And a couple months later, August 1920, he wrote the following letter to Istanbul government. "The Ottoman government continues to hang the children of the homeland on accusation of having perpetrated deportation and massacres, which now became totally senseless." Very interesting. What Kemal meant was the policy whereby the Ottoman government punished the Turks for what they had done to the Christian minorities would make sense only if Turkey received some positive results in terms of a better treaty to secure the Ottoman territories. However, several have been signed. Ottoman territories were distributed among different nations. We can conclude, this is my conclusion, had the Western forces agreed to territorial integrity in exchange for trial on case of crime against humanity, we might be talking about a very different history today in Turkey. Today, we can see, or I see, the court martial in Istanbul as a symbol of these two intertwined but distinct strengths of Turkish history. Territory and boundaries on the one side, or expressed another way, national security of Turkey, and human rights facing history and addressing historic wrongdoings on the other side. The fact that is that the attempt at the dismemberment and partition of a state as a form of punishment for the atrocities committed during the war years and proposed punishment of its nationalist leaders for seeking the territorial integrity of their state created the mindset in Turkey today that the views and the reference to the historic wrongdoings in the past as an issue of national security. A product of this mindset is therefore a belief that democratization, freedom of speech, and open and frank debate about history, acknowledgement of one's past historic misdeed, is a threat to Turkish national security. Those who invite society, like myself, to engage in an open examination of the past are therefore labeled traitors and made targets of smear campaign and dragged into courtrooms and prosecuted under Turkish Criminal Code Article 301 for insulting Turkishness. It is this kind of mindset that was behind the murder of my dear friend Hrant Dink. Reviewing Turkish history from this perspective reveals three important new perspectives for us. First, Mustafa Kemal's condemnation of the Armenian massacres is diametrically opposed to the current official Turkish policy of denial. Kemal's position, which is not sufficient for us today, however, could be a positive starting point, actually, for a resolution. To become a truly democratic member of Society of Nations, Turkey can confront the dark chapter of history and call Armenian genocide as a shameful act, as their national hero, national leader, did in 70, 80 years ago. Secondly, until now, Turkish-Armenian problem has been perceived within the old paradigm which produced the conflict, namely the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the clash of different ethnic national groups over land and boundaries in the Middle East. I think we have to change this understanding. Now what we need is a new paradigm, what we need to rethink the Turkish-Armenian conflict, and we have to reposition the Armenian-Turkish conflict within the new paradigm, what we call in scholarly word transitional justice. This means within the context of democratization of Turkey and within the context of good neighborly relations between Turkey and Armenia. And this is then the conflict should be regarded as a human rights issue and as a problem of historic injustices which has to be rectified and compensated by Turkish government for a democratic society, for a society that respects human rights. Third, the concept of Turkish national security must be revised and changed. The main flaw of this concept is its perception that the promotion of basic democratic rights, such as equality under the law, social reforms, and freedoms of speech, are a threat to national security. In the past, you may remember, or my Armenian friends know very well, the emergence of so-called Armenian question in Ottoman history was the result of Armenian demands for equality and social reforms. They didn't ask nothing but equality under the law and social reform again in Ottoman Empire, which arguably would have led to a better Ottoman society, of course. Their demands and Armenians themselves were considered a security threat, which led to them being targeted for massacres and deportations. Today, the demand for an honest account of history is being handled in the same way, as a security problem. The irony is that criminalizing historical inquiries for national security reasons is not only a huge obstacle on the path to democracy, but also is counterproductive and leads directly to real security problems for the country. This self-fulfilling prophecy can be shown not only in the Armenian genocide of the past, but of the Kurdish problem today in Turkey very clearly. Just as the Armenians and their social and political demands for a more just society were considered a threat in the past, a democratic future for Kurds today is also considered a threat to security. So instead of solving Kurdish problem by seeking solution that would lead to a more democratic society, the old and useless security concept has been resurrected and has declared that the Kurdish demands are essentially a security problem for Turkish nation. As long as Turkey continues to regard moral principles, one of which is the facing historic injustices with honesty, and national security as two opposing poles that are mutually exclusive and refuse to come to terms with the past for national security reasons. Indeed, as long as Turkey's national security is defined in opposition to an honest historic reckoning, further problems will be created in Turkey. They cannot solve Kurdish problem, and they cannot solve the human rights issues and other democratic problems in Turkey. There is a regional aspect of the problem also. A non-democratic, authoritarian Turkey creates more of a security problem than it solves when it makes the consistent denial of historical injustices an integral part of its security policy. It is exactly this attitude that delay not only democratization in the Middle East, it also destabilizes relationship in the volatile Middle East. You cannot solve any problem in the Middle East today without addressing historic wrongdoings, because history is not something in the past. Past is the present in the Middle East. You need to understand that one of the main problems in the region today is the insecurity felt by different groups towards each other as a result of the events that have occurred in history. Look, Syria. What is the determinant for Armenian attitude in Syria? What is the determinant for the Alevites' attitude in Syria? What is the determinant attitude for the Kurds in Syria today? They all remember Turkey and Turks with history, and Turkey's role in Syria would be considered within that historic context. So when you make the persistent denial of these pain-filled acts as a part of your security policy, this brings with it insecurity towards the other. This is what we call the security dilemma in our debates. What one does to enhance one's own security causes a reaction that in the end can make one less secure. For this reason, a security concept, any policies of realpolitik in and for the region that ignores morality, facing history, addressing historic wrongdoings, is doomed to fail in the end. This is why Turkey's Middle East policy will fail also in the end. So instead of helping those to deny past injustices and make this denying as a part of their security concept, our policy should integrate an honest confrontation with history into a policy of national interest in the Middle East. I believe that we will enter in a new era where morality and realpolitik will not be considered mutually exclusive. Morality is an indispensable part of realpolitik in the Middle East. Thank you very much for listening.
Many, yes, we can. Just come across. Many thanks to Professor Akçam. I should have mentioned earlier on that he did his inaugural degree at the Middle East Technical University in Ankara and his PhD in Germany in history and sociology. So we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 p.m. So we've got plenty of time. Thanks for a wide-ranging historical overview today. As you know, the events of the Armenian Genocide are close to 100 years ago now. So you've been tracing back for 9 decades plus. But you end on an optimistic note. But how long would the optimism take to fulfilment? Would it be another 100 years, 50 years? What's your time frame for some kind of positive movement along the lines you're suggesting? Just talk back to the end of the room.
It's an excellent question, and of course I have no answer to that question. But I can repeat only one saying of Caliph Ali, which we were taught in our schools. He used to say, you have to pray every day as if you will die tomorrow. But you have to work as if you never die. This is my answer to the denial question, Turkey. I believe they will accept tomorrow, but I know that I have to work very hard for the next 19 years. So this is the reality that we are facing, and I think everything depends on two important factors. One is the policy of European Union towards Turkey and policy of United States and great powers towards Turkey. They should not support a denialist regime for their security concern. This is for me equal to support an apartheid regime for any other reason. The great powers should really put the same misstep to Turkey that they put for themselves. What Australia did for its own history, they should ask Turkey to do the same thing. This is very important. So the pressure from outside. And the second important element is the civil society in Turkey. There is a rising tide of civil society, people like myself asking more human rights and democracy. I give you only one example. When I published my first book in 1991, I was the only single individual. And to talk on Armenian genocide in Turkey was a total taboo. And let alone the commemoration of Armenian genocide in public spheres. Last year, there were around 5,000 people gathered in the main square of Istanbul and commemorate the Armenian genocide, and the number raises every day, and people are asking, like the Australian history with the Aboriginals, every day more and more people asking for recognition of historic injustices. And in that connection, I think the relation between diaspora Armenians and Turkish civil society are very crucial. In that regard, the Armenian diaspora and Turkish civil society must work together for a democratic future and for justice of Armenian people. This is what I think on the question.
So,
could I ask you, is the denial by the Turkish government of Armenian genocide and resulting problems like Kurdish program somehow linked to the European Union being not that keen on getting Turkey joining the European Union?
Yes. Maybe first legal information. To acknowledge an historic injustice is not a precondition for membership of European Union. It is true. The decision was taken by European Council in 2004 regarding the Czech and Slovakia issue. During that period, the Germany and other countries in Europe asked Czech Republic to acknowledge the wrongdoings against the German minorities, and then the decision of European Council was that rectifying historic injustices cannot be made as a precondition for the membership of European Union. So Turkey doesn't have any precondition in that regard. But on the other hand, this is the legal part. But on the other side, nobody can be a member of European Union if this country drag its intellectual from courtroom to courtroom and deny the historic realities. So I totally believe that it is in the hand of European Union if they pressure Turkey more for democracy and membership towards European Union, Turkey must acknowledge something, and everybody expects this. Turkey knows that also. The problem that we have in this year is European Union changed its policy towards Turkey totally. They dropped pushing Turkey towards membership. They even very happy to exclude Turkey out of Europe. So this had a negative impact on the democratization process in Turkey. The most important reforms in Turkish history, which was around year 2002, 2003, 2004, came only because of the pressure of the European Union. So the foreign pressure had a positive impact. You have to know how to use this, and I think Turkey's membership of European Union is crucial, and on the way of Turkey's democratization, Turkey knows that they have to acknowledge something towards their history. I give you one more example maybe. There was a massacre in Turkish history, 1938. You might have heard about it. There was a Kurdish minority group, Dersim area, in eastern provinces, and approximately, the exact number nobody knows, maybe between 20 and 40,000 of Kurds in that region were massacred by Turkish army. And last year, Turkish Prime Minister made a public apology in Turkish parliament. So there are some signs also towards democratization facing history, which makes us a little bit hopeful also.
So there's a question here, then we go down the back.
Yes, what do the Turkish Armenians want from Turkey?
My dear Hrant Dink was asking only two simple demands. One is equality, equal right under the law. You have to know, unfortunately, Christians in Turkey don't enjoy the legal equality with Muslims or with the other Turkish citizens, especially regarding the question of foundation rights and some other. There are some laws, unwritten laws even, that the Christian cannot be the army officers, they cannot be in the bureaucracy, they cannot be higher bureaucrats. There are certain professions banned without having a legal restriction banned to them. And so the Christian asking legal equality, and the second is a change in the mindset. This is the most difficult one, that the Armenians in Turkey are also citizens of Turkey. They are not the others and the enemies. There are, you may not believe in it, there are court decisions in Turkey, appeal court decisions. Consider the Turkish citizen as alien citizen. Can you imagine that an Australian Supreme Court decides 10% of Australian as aliens, even though they are the citizens of Australia? This is the basic problem, and they are asking for basically equality.
There's a question down the back there. Yeah, we've got plenty of time. Yes?
There are two questions, really. About 5 years ago, did one of the Houses of Congress pass a resolution about Armenian massacre or genocide, despite Turkish protestations? And if so, what happened to bring that about and what followed from it? And the second question is the dispute in Turkey a semantic one about whether there was genocide, or an historic one about whether there was a massacre?
For the question number one, the resolution in the United States Congress didn't pass through. At the last instant, President intervened and it was dropped. The genocide resolution, the parliament resolution in America, has another important legal aspect that nobody emphasizes enough. I have to tell you this. If a Congress passes a resolution, a binding resolution, then it is possible in America to file lawsuits against Turkish companies and Turkish state. And there are already several lawsuits in California. And in some cases, the court stopped these legal procedures with the argument that the Californian state cannot interfere the federal issues and the genocide hasn't been decided as a federal policy. So the resolution in United States has a very important character, and in that sense, this is why the Armenian community tries. If you ask me, it is very important, because if such a resolution passes, Turkey must to pay, I know the legal structure a little bit, has to pay billions of dollars, and it is easier for them than to negotiate. So this is one important aspect. Regarding the semantic, yes, everything turned into the fight about the term genocide, whether it should be used or not to use for 1915. And today, the official state policy is, yeah, everybody suffered. We Turks suffered too. And 1915 was a sad day for Armenians. but it was not central planned policy. It was only some local massacres organized by local authorities, which cannot be called as genocide. I think the term genocide became a symbol of recognition of historic injustices in Turkey.
Gotta be quick.
You said that there was two treaties, Sèvres and Lausanne, were diametrically opposite. What changed in Paris with the Allies, with the peace talks, to change and for the Allies to drop the Wilsonian principles of self-determination and go for to establishing the Turkish state in 1923?
It's an excellent question. I love to quote to my students a statement of Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Great Britain of the time, and again a piece of history, the Wilsonian Armenia, the Armenians were asking actually 80,000 allied forces. And they were talking about the numbers and the weapons and the arms and so on. The Armenian delegation in Paris said that we are this amount of people, we can protect this region, we can train. What we want from you is send us some officers to train the Armenians and send a troop of 80,000 people. This is what we need, the rest we can do that. And in this negotiation, Lloyd George said a wonderful statement which summarized actually the great power policy. He said, if we occupy a territory, we have to finance the cost of occupation by the locals. This is the reason why we occupied Iraq, because of the oil, and we can support the cost of occupation by the Iraqi oil. And what has the Armenians to give? Nothing. So they couldn't finance the occupation by the act of occupation. So they dropped the entire process. And for the France, they signed an economic agreement with Turkey. They got the 80 or 90 years of the, for the mines in certain areas and so on. So Turkey was stronger than Armenians. And there was a third important reason. It was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And Great Britain had a great interest to have a block to stop the expansion of Bolsheviks through the Middle East. And the Turks helped the Great Britain. This was the third important reason.
Down there. Yes.
One of the consequences of the 90-plus years of Turkey's denial of the Armenian genocide is that some very important stories have been lost, and those are the stories of the Turks who rescued Armenians during the genocide. Now, that losing of those stories is bad for both Turks and for Armenians. I just want to say, as an Armenian, that you as a person keep the spirit of those rescuers alive.
There's a question about the Turks who rescued Armenians around the time of 1915.
And how are you doing? I know him from Toronto. Great to see you here. It is true. We have our Schindlers a lot, but we don't like to talk. I mean, especially I hear this again and again from my Armenian friends. After any event, they come to me and they say, you know, the reason why we are alive, because of some Muslims that saved our life, our parents' life, but we cannot talk on this because of this denialist policy of your government. It is true, and this is one of the reasons that we set up a prize, an award in Turkey, in Istanbul. So we established a Hrant Dink, International Hrant Dink Foundation. I'm one of the active members of this foundation. And there is a fund, a research fund, and it supports the young researchers to find Muslims who saved Armenian lives in order to show that we have another history on which we can build our future. It is really very crucial, and we have to work very hard in that direction.
So there's a question here that we can go down the back. Yes?
I understand that the Kurds played a rather shameful part
and persecution and the killing of the reported Armenians. To what extent do the Turks actually use this as part of their kind of an excuse for what happened?
Question about the role of the Kurds in the killing of Armenians.
Armenian genocide, and even there are some new theories written by scholars arguing that to clean the hand of the Turkish government in Istanbul, saying that it was the barbaric Kurds in the eastern provinces killed the Armenians, and it has nothing to do with Turkish government. Unfortunately, we don't have enough studies what happened in local areas. In history writing, it's always bad to generalize. Kurds versus Turks and so on. If we look very closely, we can see that indeed there were some Kurdish tribes sided with Turkish government or Ottoman government and organized by Turkish government in paramilitary units, which we called Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa. This is the Ottoman word, means special organization. And Kurds was the major part of this organization, and they participate in killing of Armenians. But we know also there are thousands of Kurds who saved the Armenian lives. And today, there is another important distinction that you have to know. If you go to eastern provinces where the Kurds live, or the historic Armenia today, you will hear a lot of stories. Kurds talking very openly about the past because of their own experiences now, and they acknowledge these historic wrongdoings. And every day, one after another, Kurds or Muslims comes up and they recognize their Armenian origin. I give you only one example, a province which I call Dersim. Recently, the Dersim Kurds established an association, and they have now approximately 600 members who recognize their Armenian origin. Dersim Armenians, 700 members, and we assume that there are thousands of individuals in Kurdish families assimilated. And so today, this could be used as an argument by Turks to wash their hands by some Turkish nationalists, but it cannot help them much because there are several reasons, but one simple reason, 1916, summer months, there were a second wave of genocide where 200,000 Armenians were massacred in the desert of Derzor in today's Syria, and there were no Kurds there. Somebody killed them.
So there's a question down there.
Yes,
it's going to be quick, yep.
Okay, I've just got two questions.
No, one will do. Okay.
Well, I'll put my hand up twice.
Yeah, one question.
So, first question I'd like to ask is, openly and clearly, the Turkish government has made the archives of the Ottoman Empire open to general people from the public for many, many years. And I would like to ask, have you ever seen the archives from the Armenian government that has never been open?
Okay, that'll do. Okay, so the question, suggestion is that the Turks have opened their archives, but no archives from Armenians have been opened. That's the suggestion. Okay, then we go over here. Yeah.
I would recommend to read the first chapter of my book. You will find extensive information about the archival materials, which are open and which are closed.
From where?
From Turkey and Armenia.
Okay, look,
don't worry. Don't
interjections today. You can buy the book outside and you can read it. Okay.
You can read it. No, I will give. I know what, it, my dear friend. What's your name?
Hussein
Yorman. Hussein, I understand what Hussein is asking about the Armenian archives. It is a myth to believe that there is an archive in Armenian which is held closed. It is a myth. The archives in Armenia open, number one. Number two, it's not important because the archive of Armenia state as state established 1921. It is after the genocide, and there is no records of 1915 in Armenian archives. They are open, you can go and see. But there is an important point that you should know. These materials related to 1915, which we know mostly belong to the Dashnak Situn party, and the archive of Dashnak Situn party in Boston, in Watertown. It was opened until 1990s and closed now for the purpose of digitizing, but it is still closed. And I know from some scholars who worked in that archive, and this archive must be open to everybody, no doubt about it. Like the General Staff Archive, the military archives in Ankara, it is also closed to everybody. And but 1915 materials related 1915 in the Dashnak-Stuyun archive is thin, because the entire organization was destroyed. We know some of the materials. There are some PhDs written on the Union and Progress and Dashnak-Stuyun relations based on the Dashnak's archive in Watertown. We scholars know the materials. This is not an excuse, but to keep this material closed. But I assure you, we cannot find, we won't be able to find some other so much interesting materials in Dashnak-Stuyun archive in Watertown.
We've got a question over here. We're cutting to the end.
One. Just having returned today from Greece and Turkey, I'd like to ask you whether you think history would have been different and the Smyrna massacre would have been avoided if the Greek army had not pushed east towards Ankara, if it had been content to stay with the Asia Minor Greek provinces along the coast. Many Greeks told me that was...
Okay, right.
It has nothing to do with Armenian genocide. This is the occupation of Smyrna, 1919 May, and afterwards the developments. It is important for the Pontus, the massacres and killings of the Pontus Greeks in the Black Sea region. And this is another dark side of Ottoman Turkish history, but related to 1915 and Armenian genocide, it was irrelevant because it was during the war years, 1915.
Just a final... Sorry, do you want to answer that?
No, okay, go ahead. No.
Okay, just a final question. You live in the United States now, but you travel to Turkey regularly. So what's your relationship with your colleagues in Turkish civil society and with the administration and government in Ankara?
Now, today is 31st. After tomorrow, November 2nd, there will be a conference in Mardin, the province in eastern Anatolia, on the massacres against Assyrians and on the province of Mardin. I give it only as an example that Turkey has changed since 2005. You may recall the first unofficial conference on Armenian genocide was organized by us 2005 in Istanbul. It was a huge public event. Weeks after weeks, the newspapers mentioned only about this event. And today, every year, we have 2, 3, 4 conferences in different universities, nobody writes. This is now normalized in that sense. My relation with Turkish government, I tell you one anecdote and let's finish that way. In Isfahan, I was traveling Isfahan, it's a beautiful city in Iran, and I was the guest of Armenian community, and we traveled the old palace in Isfahan, and I saw the Turkish health ministry and minister there, and my guide is an Armenian, but from Turkey, he speaks Turkish, and then I told him in Turkish, "Oh, our minister is here, I saw him." And somebody approached to me and asked me who I am, and I said, "I'm Taner Akçam." "Oh, Mr. Akçam, I'm the public relations officer of the health minister. I would be delighted to introduce you to our minister." And he pushed me to the health minister, and of course he knew my name, and we shaked hands, and how beautiful the palace is, and so on and so forth. But then after we left, there was a turmoil there. Iranian security officers, police, was upset that I was pushed in front of the minister without informing them, and there was a really back and forth argument there because I could be a terrorist or assassinate the health minister. And then afterwards, I approached to him, the guy, when I was leaving there. I said, "I'm so sorry. I thought I heard the wrangle there. I'm so sorry that I caused a problem for you." He said, "Mr. Akçam, you are a respected historian of Turkey. It is, of course, my duty to introduce you to my minister." So this is my relation with... I'm sure that they don't like me very much, but we have a very civilized relations.
That's a very nice way to win. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.